Well, we are about halfway through Lent season, 3 weeks till Palm Sunday, and this passage fits nicely into that season of preparation. We know from the Gospels, Jesus is already in Jerusalem. This passage is in three different Gospels, almost word for word the same, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. This is the day after he turned the tables in the temple. So Jesus has created a little bit of stir, a little bit of disruption in the temple in Jerusalem. And the religious leaders, not merely the Pharisees this time, this is the big religious leaders, are like, on whose authority are you saying any of this stuff? Like, how dare you? Who do you think you are that you can come in here and flip our tables and tell us these parables? Jesus, in all of his wisdom, seems to know the right things to test their hearts and challenges them when they ask him this question. Jesus says, let me see here. I'm trying to find my notes. I didn't put it in quotes. Jesus tests their hearts, asks them about John the Baptist. In chapter 21, same section here. He says, was John the Baptist a prophet or was he not? And these religious leaders didn't know what to say. They knew it was a trap and they didn't understand where Jesus was going to go with this. But they knew if John the Baptist was a prophet, then they should not have killed him if he had been sent from God. But if they said he was not a prophet, they also understood the crowds loved John the Baptist, and they may have murdered these people if they said he was not a prophet. So Jesus trapped them, made them uncomfortable, and then began to tell two parables. One is the parable of two sons. One son Jesus gave an instruction to, and he said, I will do it. And the son did not do the thing. The other son, the father gave an instruction to, the son did not want to do it, but later ended up doing the thing. Which son is more honorable? The one who did the thing. And then they continue to ask, and then Jesus says, let me tell you another parable. And then goes on to tell us this story. It's more a question not of an authority over the land, but Jesus tells this parable about these tenants because it's a question of who owns the land. Is it the tenants who worked the land, or the land owner? And we're going to dig into this a little bit. But I want to set the table for us because Jesus does something really interesting here. He goes back to Isaiah chapter 5. They would have known this. Isaiah chapter 5, starting at verse 1, it goes through 7 here, describes God as a vintner, a wine maker. Listen to this. I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one has a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad grapes. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, Why did it only yield bad grapes? Now I will tell you, what am I going to do with my vineyard? I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but heard cries of distress. Isaiah chapter 5. A few pieces of imagery here that Jesus captures into his stories. He builds a wall to protect what's been provided. He cuts a wine press into the stone, anticipating a great harvest. It was not a portable wine press, but he built one into the land, anticipating generations of production. He raised a watchtower to remind the people of his presence. He did everything to prepare this land to bear good fruit, and it produced sour grapes. Now, how many of us are good fans of sour grapes? No. And it is quite disappointing when you get the green grapes, and when they're good, they're very good. But man, you get one sour one, and it's like, I am done eating grapes. One sour grape ruins the whole experience for me. When God is talking about sour grapes here in Isaiah, and Jesus, as he's referencing this passage, he's reminding the religious leaders, there's bad fruit. There is bad fruit. I'm about to take the land away from you. And then, of course, he quotes Psalm 118, verse 22. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. The Lord has done it this very day. Let us rejoice and be glad. Friends, as we lead up to Good Friday and the crucifixion of Christ, he is also here in the temple pointing himself toward that crucifixion. This is a cruciform story, one that shapes the very narrative, the outcome, the direction that Christ is intending on going. He makes it clear. We see this witnessed in three of the Gospels. John tells different stories. Christ intends on dying by the hands of the tenants of his land. But it's not so much a surprise to us as we have the whole story unfolding in our own lives, right? The parable doesn't really end at the cross. We know the plan of God is for resurrection, for new life. But there's some deeper truths in this passage that remind us of the Father's heart and the hope that he has and the intricacies of his plans and how wise he is to go around our very nature to steal and take from him and plant firmly his good intentions, to build his kingdom from the bottom. This parable is rich in picture and analogy. Let's start here. Let's talk about citizenship and land rights. As we've talked as through this series of the treasure parables, and next week is our final parable. This week is our penultimate. I love that word. Penultimate. We've talked about being ambassadors to this world for the kingdom of heaven. That Christ, in redeeming us and calling us into his body, into his church, has now empowered us, emboldened us, and given us all the resources of the king and his kingdom to be ambassadors for his good will to the earth. Friends who have given their life to Christ, who have said, "Yes, God, I will go. You have changed my heart. Let me be your ambassador." He has now given you all the tools, all the resources of his. Just pull out your debit card and run the ATM. That's an old sentence. People don't use ATMs anymore. And withdraw the resources of the kingdom to apply to his good works, the things that he intends on doing. The treasure parables are not designed to help us become rich in worldly possessions. But the wealth of the king and his kingdom and the nations is all within our grasp, not for our comfort, but to show his love, his invitation, to welcome people into his family. So we talk about our citizenship as ambassadors in the kingdom and the rights that we have as his tenants, as the ones who are doing the work, as Isaiah reminds us, producing good fruit. There will be a people who will produce good fruit. Friends, we are that people. We are the ones who Isaiah prophesied about 2,500 years ago, when he said, "I will give my vineyard to a people that will produce good fruit." Last week, when we walked through the prodigal son parable and watched two sons, both really deeply misunderstand the father's economy, the way the father's riches and life work, we watch what happened when a misunderstanding hardens one's will, and ultimately the will to kill or end a life. When we look at this passage, we see a continuing story of almost a worsening, hardening of hearts. So last week we had two sons who didn't kill their father, but you could see the disruption in their hearts. This week we have a worse, more hardened heart. In fact, a story where death is applied. So the question becomes, who owns this land? Who Who gets the fruit? And I think Jesus is asking this question here in a tricky way. He, right at the beginning of the parable, he says, the master sent his servants to collect his fruit. And they reject the servants. Now, in the first century, these absentee owners, it was a pretty common event. Like, you'd have people you worked for that didn't live nearby. And what's interesting is the tenants in this passage would not have had any real legal standing to the son's inheritance. So why would they think they could kill him to gain his inheritance? Isn't that a weird thing for them to say? Let's kill to get the son's inheritance. In first century law, if the heir of the land was killed and there was no living claimant, the owners had no sons left to give the land to, the claim was opened. Therefore, the tenants would have gained possession by default. This is, in a way, an overthrow. They believed they had the right to the land because they were the ones that were producing the fruit. They claimed ownership over this land. Who does the land belong to? Obviously, when we look at their attitudes toward trying to take over the land and not wanting the master, the landowner, to gain the property and the value out of the property, thinking their stewardship was better than his, we get this idea of hubris. We had this conversation. Hubris. It's a rich word. Obviously, when we look at the stories of the Pharisees and the religious leaders of Jesus' time, there's a lot of hubris, a lot of arrogance, a lot of entitlement. Because of what I've done, I deserve this. Because I have seen success, this is going to happen. Hubris blinds us. It makes us believe things are within our control. So when Jesus launches this parable at them, they know immediately he's talking about their hubris, their entitlement to this land. They know the truth and they continue to reject it. Remember the passage in Isaiah. God was looking for justice and found blood. Their lives were not producing the kind of fruit that the Father intended. It's almost as if the expertise of the religious leaders became their blindness. The more qualified you are, the more righteous your grievances feel. Does that not feel true to you guys? I wrote my own parable. Listen along. I hope this helps us to get maybe a better understanding. Imagine you're a master vineyard, the person that cultivates the vineyard, okay? You've spent decades under a world-class vintner, a true legend of his time. You didn't just learn the trade of making wine, you became the trade. You were so in sync with the methods of this world-class vintner that your hands moved to the rhythms of his. You can taste in the soil the grape before it ever hits the wine press. In fact, you became so good, you were the silent architect of some of the finest wines this vineyard ever produced, even though they carried the name of the master vintner. At this time, it was finally your chance to shine. You were ready to launch out on your own. So you found a vineyard to work for, hired by a man with great wealth. The man knew nothing of the vine, but he spared no expense to make this the most beautiful estate in the region. This man built an 8-foot stone wall around the perimeter that must have cost more than the land itself. His mansion sat above the vineyard like a crown. He hired armed security to patrol the land, protecting his treasure from the thieves. He gave you the keys and told you to make him wine. And then he left. For years, the owner traveled the world on the profits of your sweat. But every few months, he'd sweep back onto the property like a conquering hero. He would sit on his veranda, overlooking the rows you had pruned and the soil you had bled into. He would hold up a glass of your finest work, catch the light in a deep red hue, and raise a glass and toast to himself, congratulating his own genius for this vintage. As you fill his glass, he drinks deep, wipes the wine from his lips, and says, "I really outdid myself this year, didn't I?" And then his expertise would kick in. The owner, who spent his afternoons in air-conditioned hotels, would start telling you that the workers were lazy, that he'd look at the men and women who had worked through the frost and the heat and say they take too many breaks. The sun is up. They should be bending over the vines. Why am I paying for them to sit? Grapes don't pick themselves. And this past summer, the heat was brutal. You were in the cool of the barn, barreling the new crop. You and the crew were exhausted, but the work was good. You had the radio playing, a little music to keep the rhythm, some laughs, a shared glass of the workers' wine to keep the spirits up. It was a beautiful communal joy of a well-earned harvest. Suddenly, the doors swing open. The owner was back, face flushed with a different kind of heat. He didn't see the barrels. He didn't see the art. He saw people not working. He didn't say hello. He walked straight to the radio, smashed it onto the concrete floor. And sudden, ringing silence, he screamed, "Do you have any idea how hard I work to afford this place? I come home expecting to see my investment producing, and I find you lounging in the shade, enjoying the fruit of my land. Either you run this vineyard my way, or get out." The workers, people you've loved, and the craft you invested your life in, the broken plastic on the floor. You try to plead to the workers. You told them you'd make it right, that the owner was probably just tired, but they had seen this play out before. They knew that to stay was to serve a man who wanted the wine, but hated the vine. And they left. That night you were alone, your back was screaming, your hands were cramped into claws as you looked at the silent, fortified vineyard behind that expensive stone wall. You realize the wine is world class, but the cost to me is too high. After the last bottle was corked, you packed your bags, left the keys on the gate, and walked away from a treasure that was never allowed to be yours. The tragic story, and one the Pharisees told themselves as Christ comes to them and says, I'm taking the land back. Friends, in our heart, we are all this way. The hubris of our own merit, of our own hard work, we believe we have the right to the land that we've invested so much time in. And the Pharisees saw Jesus as one who is unworthy of their life, unworthy to serve. They were the experts. They were the ones with the credentials. They were the ones who had worked for years producing the fruit on these vines. Do you see? Do you see why this parable gets directly to their heart? Friends, they are justified in their own eyes. They believe what they were doing was righteous. They were not the villains in their story. They were the main character. And that is what made them capable of killing the Son. Do you see it? Believing their intention for the land justified the betrayal. Friends, success can be the most dangerous blindfold. Especially when you have results that you can point to. In this passage, we see the temple is running, the laws being kept, the borders were being held. They were safe under Roman authority. And Jesus came and threatened all that they had worked for. When the system's working, it's very easy to confuse your management with God's blessing. And they didn't simply reject Jesus because they didn't like him. They had a strong theological case for what they were planning to do. He was a threat to the stability under Rome. They needed to appease Roman authority so the Romans could protect the Israelites. Israel had been through so much turmoil in the last 600 years, and they were finally secure. And here's the trick. You guys remember the story of Jacob and Esau, where they tricked their father Isaac into giving the blessing to Jacob. Jacob puts on the furry arms because his brother Esau is a hairy man. I'm not a hairy man, so I can't empathize, but But the whole thing started because Jacob made a good bowl of soup. And Esau said, I will give you my inheritance for that bowl of soup. Friends, we just think so often that what we have in our hands cannot be lost. That what we work for is ours. And the Israelites, like Esau, sold their birthright for a bowl of soup, for the promise of a tomorrow under Roman law. Friends, our hubris demands that we be treated like kings in a vineyard that we stole. The gospel here invites us to become servants in a kingdom that does not belong to us. The treasures in our pockets are not ours. They are not here for us to purchase our comforts, to protect ourselves. This is what it looks like when we become injustice collectors. Have you guys heard that phrase before, an injustice collector? We live in a world where many of us collect injustice. It's, I think, quite common. Here's my jar of injustices. They're pennies, so they're probably worth a lot more than they used to be. But it's what self-justification looks like. We keep a jar of the wrongs that have been done, not necessarily to us, but to others. The way things ought to be when they go wrong, we put the injustice in our jar. Every slight is another penny. Every mistreatment adds weight to the jar of our injustice collection. The worse the injustice, the more righteous the rejection feels. Look how far this jar of injustices is. Look how big that is. I carry so much injustice around. Look at all the injustices that I have. It makes us feel like we're martyrs, like we've collected all these things, and somehow it makes me more innocent. We trade deep, vulnerable connections with others for the privilege of being right with a spouse, with a friend. Instead of apologizing, saying I've been wrong, we put that penny in our jar and go, no, I'm right. We prefer it that way. Friends, the Pharisees didn't wake up one day deciding to kill Jesus. They arrived there, one grievance against God at a time, carrying the injustices that have been done to them over and over. Friends, what jar are you filling? What grievances do you carry? Because these are the kind of things that convince us we have a right to this land. Look at the weight I have been carrying around for you for generations. Do you feel that? The injustice. Friends, there is only one way for justice There's only one true justifier. The tenants read the father's patience in this story as a weakness, as if sending continual servants is just the father, the owner, being weak and not coming himself. But here's the miracle in this story. This was not weakness. This is relinquishment. It's a big word. And there's a difference between being weak and letting go. And the father cared so much for the land and its fruit that he was willing to send his son into the den. The son fully knowing what it was going to cost him. How does that even work? Here's this biblical parallel for this. How many of you guys remember Abraham and Isaac, a very famous story where Abraham takes his son on instruction from God to go and sacrifice his child on the top of a mountain? It is brutal. What a bizarre story. God says, go and take your son. Friends, it's only in the willingness to relinquish our rights to the promise of God that that promise can continue. Do you see it? Isaac did not get the inheritance of Abraham's promise without Abraham being willing to let it go. Isaac was the one who had to carry the promise. And when God said, let it go, and God saw that he was willing, the sacrifice came. Friends, Christ is the sacrifice that completed the sacrifice at the top of that mountain. Christ is the sacrifice of the landowner who sent his son in, knowing full well in his death there would be no land inheritance. This was letting go, relinquishment. That is not weakness, but it's only in the willingness to go in and under and die, and by letting go, can we find resurrection? Because what Jesus knows in this story, and we don't necessarily see, and the religious leaders didn't see, was there was a resurrection. The son went into the land, the tenants killed him, the claim was lost, but the son was resurrected and received the land back. So the sacrifice has to happen for the inheritance to continue. It goes against our economic instinct, the one who dies loses the assets, right? The tenants in this story ended up being destroyed for a claim on the land. The son dies to transfer the inheritance to us. Friends, Christ's death does not restore some old arrangement. It creates a new promise, a new hope that in his resurrection, there can be a redeemed land. There's a new kind of vineyard. One where the vines bear great fruit. And the walls aren't designed to keep people out, but to invite people in. While our instinct says the one who dies loses the asset, the gospel says the one who dies becomes the asset. Friends, the cross is the ultimate market disruption in a world where we carry the weight of injustice as a badge of our own justification. Christ takes the weight of that on his shoulders. Says, let go of the land. Let go. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 4. In a bit of a rebuke and the behavior of the Corinthians, he says, verse 1 and 2, this then is how you ought to regard us, Paul and his crew, as servants of Christ and as those who entrusted with the mysteries that God has revealed. Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. Paul tells us we are not the owners of this good news, but we are the stewards, the inheritors, the tenants, the workers in the field who have been called to produce great fruit. Faithfulness is the metric the landowner is looking for. And we have to be okay with the owner getting credit. Friends, the cross that curses leads to blessing. The death and slandering is answered with kindness. This is what Christ is looking for. This is why he came. Because in our own desires, we want to take the land for ourselves. But we are not the heir. Yet in the cross, we still get the land. We get to live it, produce, and give glory to the Father for the good things that he's done. I'm going to invite our worship team up. Friends, injustice collectors always end up alone, destroyed behind an expensive wall in a fortified vineyard, holding the treasures that no one else cares for. The call in this parable is not to justify ourselves, not to see what we've done as worthy of taking ownership of the land, because nothing we can do can claim the ownership of what the Father has provided. The call here is to relinquish, to let go, not to give up, but to give in. Not to weakness, but in the strength of submission, in the strength of letting go, in the strength of the willingness to allow the Father's goodwill to happen through our lives. Would you guys stand with me? Name what you've been holding on to. Name the jar of the things that you've been collecting. Maybe you can let this go. Name the things that you've been treating as your own. Maybe you have a legal case. Let it go. Christ does not want us carrying our jar of burdens. He takes them on himself and justifies us in his death. Friends, the cross doesn't forgive the theft of the vineyard. It gives the vineyard back as a gift. So as we go into song in response, stop white knuckling. Stop holding on to the things that we think belong to us. Let the moment of the gift become real.